Welcome, listeners, to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. This is the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues. We want to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire you. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring you a broad range of topics and expertise. I'll be your host today, Dr. Kim McCrary, Southwest Regional Director and Staff Scientist with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. NM Wild, as we are known by many, is a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting and restoring New Mexico's wild places through advocacy and education and ultimately legislation. For today's show, join us to listen to a recently held economic forum in Silver City on community development, tourism, and public lands. Sponsored by NM Wild and the Southwest Green Chamber of Commerce, an economist presents the latest data showing that protected public lands give the West a competitive economic advantage and discusses the economic potential we have because of the Gila National Forest. Two local business owners share their insights, tips, and firsthand experiences in the tourism industry.
Well, welcome to this evening's Economic Forum. Community Development, Tourism, and Public Lands. I'm Sissy McAndrew, Executive Director of the Southwest New Mexico Green Chamber of Commerce, and very pleased to welcome you. In addition to the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance, we're pleased to be partnering for this event this evening. First, we'd like to thank the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and Bear Mountain Lodge for providing refreshments. Now on with the forum. Given that we have more than 2,700,000 acres of some of the finest country in our backyard, this forum was created to commence a conversation about how we can economically benefit from our federally protected public lands. Tonight, we are fortunate to have three experts that will give us presentations, and then we'll open up the floor for questions and answers. Community discussion will also continue. It's now my pleasure to introduce our first panelists this evening. Ben Alexander is co-founder and associate director of Headwaters Economics, an independent nonprofit research group whose mission is to improve community development and land management decisions in the West. Ben has worked with land management agencies, elected officials, rural development specialists, and landowners for the last 15 years. He has published in areas of ranch and energy economics, the value of public lands, and community development. Ben will be talking about the latest research on community development and the economic role of public lands.
It's a pleasure to be here. Again, my name is Ben Alexander. I co-founded Headwaters Economics, which is a regional think tank focusing on land management and rural development in the West. And it's been a heck of a day already. Got up in a blizzard in Montana this morning at about 4 a.m. to hop on a plane and come down here. Flew into El Paso and just couldn't believe my eyes. The blue sky and the open space again, just fantastic. But what a contrast. And then to come back up here in the mountains and feel a little bit more at home, also very nice. So I appreciate the welcome. I'm going to talk about some recent research that we've done on the economics of public lands, and in particular, the importance of protected public lands for non-metropolitan economies around the West. And by non-metropolitan, I mean not the Albuquerques and the Denvers and the Salt Lake Cities of the West, but most of the West, most of the lands and most of the medium and small-sized communities around the West. So what I want to do is actually talk to you about how the West performs economically in relation to the United States, and we're a star, by the way, and then funnel down, gradually talk about the non-metropolitan West, to talk specifically about how public lands play a role in supporting and driving our economy in the non-metropolitan West, and then drill down into what I call the Gila region, which is really, when I think about it, and if you think about it differently, I apologize, the three-county area surrounding the Gila Wilderness and the National Forest here, including Catron, Grant, and Sierra counties. And then I'll end with some comments, and which is always risky as an outsider, a couple of sort of ideas about things that could happen here to support economic development and land protection. I was going to talk for an hour and a half, but I was told that I have 20 minutes. So I'm going to pare it down a little bit. So the first thing I want to share with you is this slide. It's something that we've talked about a lot at Headwaters Economics as staff. It's just remarking on the fact that the Western economy outperforms the national economy in basic metrics of economic growth and has done so for over 40 years. You can see incredible disparities of employment, population, and personal income growth between the 11 Western states. And when I say the West, I mean the 11 Western public land states in the continental U.S. So Montana down to New Mexico and out to the coast. Not Alaska, not Hawaii, and not North Dakota and Texas. You can envision that. And so we began asking ourselves, why this performance? What's going on? Now let's try to understand it a little bit, and then we'll weave down into the role of public lands in this. So what's driving growth? What's driving growth is, from an employment perspective, an industry perspective, are services. And you've seen the broad employment and personal income growth as compared to the nation just a minute ago. But here I want you to think about what's created 100% of net new jobs in the West in the last four decades. And that's a mix of service industries. And these are typically misunderstood. They're everything from accommodation and food services, which are understood fairly well, and are relatively low wage and low skill. But it also includes doctors, lawyers, engineers, and architects. Healthcare, what they call, what U.S. Department of Commerce calls professional, scientific, and technical services. And a range of other things, including finance and information services and software development and some of the more interesting things that our national and regional economy are doing right now. So if 100% of net new jobs in the West in the last 40 years are created in services, let's dig into them just a little bit so we understand what's really going on. Just looking at the last decade here, it's 2001 to 10 instead of 2010 because of an anomaly in how the U.S. Department of Commerce categorizes industries that, unfortunately, I'm not empowered to change. But here are the sort of basic 20 industries using the North American Industrial Classification System that our federal government uses to classify industries. And you can see that all the main creators of new jobs in the West over the last decade are services. The biggest, of course, being healthcare, adding almost 800,000 new jobs. Real estate and leasing and rental activities, over 500,000 new jobs. Finance and insurance, almost 400,000 new jobs. At the same time, manufacturing and construction are the leading sectors losing jobs in the West. Manufacturing alone lost over 400,000 jobs, and construction 367,000 jobs just in the last 11 years. What we saw happening to agriculture in the 19th and early 20th centuries, we're seeing in the last 50 years, and we'll see continually going forward, manufacturing jobs being trimmed because of developments and advancements in robotics and technology. Even though President Obama talked a lot about, and both candidates talked a lot about, you know, a renaissance in American manufacturing, it's going to be very difficult to do for basic structural reasons having to do with technology and robotics, as well as some global free trade issues. But that said, where does that leave us in 2010, looking at the West as a whole? 72% of the job base in the West is service-oriented. 14% is non-services, which includes mining, energy development, manufacturing, and construction. 14%. Now, those jobs have been relatively steady outside the energy development industry, which is very volatile. But they've been holding relatively steady. When I focus on the new jobs is where the opportunities are. Lest you think I was just going to leave you with the West as a whole, and as you know, if you look at things in a macro scale, the big cities will drown out the rural areas and the micropolitan areas. The same pattern we see in the West as a whole with the big cities is happening in the non-metropolitan West. And to give you a sense, there are 414 counties in the 11 Western states. 268 of those are non-metropolitan, so about two-thirds. Now, in these two-thirds, over the last 40 years, we've created of over 2 million new jobs. Almost 100% of them have been in services in rural and micropolitan areas. Now, micropolitan by definition is this. It's any county that does not have an incorporated area with 50,000 people or more. So we're really talking about pretty small places. If we look at the industry pattern, it's virtually the same. Healthcare leading, real estate and finance. Government is more important in the non-metro West, and it's very important here in Grant County. You can see mining has created jobs in the non-metropolitan West, 26,000 over this time period. But if we look at this from a share standpoint, 2010, Services, 64% of the economy, 2010. Non-services, 19%. Government, 18%. It's a little different than how people typically describe the economy. We often think of Main Street. We look around Main Street or coming in and out of town. I think we understand the economy. Beware that windshield survey. There's a lot more going on. One thing we uncovered in the recent West is Best research, and West is Best is what we're calling this latest effort trying to understand why the West has outperformed the nation so significantly, is just how widespread services are. We took a look at all counties in the West, which are 414, and we said, how many counties have over 70% of their private employment in services industries? Turns out 49% of the counties in the West. Equally divided between metropolitan and non-metropolitan, 101 and 102 on each. Now we said, how about high-wage services? Let me explain those for a sec. We took the six services sectors that on average have the highest wages, and they're these ones, from management of companies and enterprises down to wholesale trade. They average, for the West, have an average earnings per job of almost $82,000. The average earning for all private industries in the West is just about $50,000. If we take just these sectors and we ask how many counties in the West have over 15% of their total private employment base in these high-wage services, it's 165 counties, or 40% of Western counties. Now, are non-metropolitan counties getting into the action here? Well, 88 of those counties are metropolitan, 77 of them are non-metropolitan. So yes, they are. And in many ways, the economic challenge that we face looking forward is how to compete for not just service jobs, because that's where we're creating jobs by and large, but how to create for the higher paying service jobs and understanding what they need and why they locate where they do and the kind of talent they require. So what is the West's competitive advantage given the economic geography I've just laid out, which is, in essence, that our economy is increasingly a service-based economy, and that there's fierce competition for the higher wage, higher skill aspects of that economy. Well, here's a quote from Enrico Moretti in his recent book, The New Geography of Jobs, which I thought accurately encapsulates, I think, the shift that's taken place. Over the past century, the United States has shifted from an economy centered on producing physical goods to one centered on innovation and technology. In the 20th century, competition was about accumulating physical capital. Today, it's about attracting the best human capital. So that has really profound implications for what competitive strengths are. It used to be if there was copper in the ground and we had the technologies to get it out of the ground and we had a market for that copper, that was a competitive advantage. And it still is for places that do that. But those industries, by and large, are not creating a lot of new jobs today because they're incredibly mature and they're highly mechanized. For the rest of the economy, what matters? Skills and knowledge matter. They matter more than they did in the past. And if you look at the statistics on length of time unemployed, earnings, and down the line, it turns out education and skills are incredibly important. Knowledge-intensive industries are less constrained by location than in the past, with revolutions in transportation and telecommunications. They're also not producing as bulky of goods. They're producing services, and they're working in knowledge-based arenas increasingly. And it turns out knowledge workers are attracted to places where they want to live, not just following careers. And for this project, we talked to several corporate recruiters on the West Coast in this case. And they had really powerful quotes about how place and quality of life has become more a part of selling a job and headhunting a candidate for a position than it ever has been in the past. Now, this is particularly true in industries that are fiercely competitive around trying to get in, let's say, software engineers. You know, there aren't enough, and we can't make them fast enough in order to keep competing. Well, if you have what those engineers want, that is to say, you have a quality of life or a place that they find attractive, you have a competitive advantage in this new evolving economy that we're building here in the West. So what does this mean for us? I just want to recap a couple things. Services are driving the economy. Business locations, a big literature on this, you know, that business location decisions, particularly for newer sector industries, are less about cost and more about quality. Something that's going to be really important in our conversation about the Gila region here is that we're getting older. We're getting older in the U.S., we're getting older in the West, and we're really, you'll see in a minute, we're quite a bit older here in the Gila region, and a little bit older here in this room. I feel like good company. But it has profound economic implications, both because the baby boom generation in particular is remarkably wealthy and is tapping into accumulated wealth that in many cases are more frugal Depression era parents saved, and in some cases wealth that they themselves have created. And for many places, it's the largest single income stream these communities will see. But it's changing where we live. It's changing the needs of our needs, particularly our medical needs, as we age. And it's a huge opportunity for places that have the kind of qualities that can attract an aging population and retain them. Lastly, people are moving to high-quality places. We can see it, and I'm going to show you some research on that in just a minute. But lest you think I only think the new economy matters or high-wage services matter, I want to reiterate that whether we call it the older economy or goods-producing sectors or non-services industries, these industries aren't going away. In fact, they're really important. Just because they aren't creating jobs doesn't mean we don't need to think about them. And in many ways, the challenge, particularly as we think about managing and protecting and using our public lands, is how to layer these economies together so that they don't create externalities for each other.
Stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. We're listening to Headwaters economist Ben Alexander.
So what role public lands? Well, let me first say, we have many more public lands as a share of our total land base in the West than the rest of the country. In fact, 46% of our lands in the 11 Western states here are owned and managed by you and me and the federal government, as compared to 15% for the rest of the country. Now, many of those are managed for multiple use objectives, as you know, and a number of them are set aside for their natural, cultural, and historical features. We created a definition of protected public lands. We had to in order to measure economies around them, and we peer-reviewed published data in a number of journals. It's essentially capturing our federal public lands that are things like national parks, national monuments, legislated wilderness areas, national wildlife refuges, and those kinds of things. Things that can't just be changed administratively and go away, like a wilderness study area. Things that have more durability to them, as well as more visibility to them. So with that definition, I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the research that the economists at USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, have done. They have a fabulous research department called the Economic Research Service. And they have increasingly realized that natural amenities, and by that they mean the natural landscape and how scenic it is, the cleanliness of the water, the fact that it has mountains and canyons, and these types of attributes. It turns out people really like that. It's funny, I put it one time, that they like topographic change. They like the canyons and they like the mountains. And the people are voting with their feet on that one. Well, they found, looking specifically at the baby boomer generation, and those are folks born from the end of the Second World War through 1964. Those folks have entered, the older of them have entered retirement, and many are on their way there. This is looking at a three-decade perspective, the 1990s to the 2000s, and you can see the highest natural amenity quintile on the right. Those places that they've actually developed a natural amenities index. Those places across the country that have the highest natural amenities are attracting the most baby boomers. Significantly so. Now, this is important not just because, this can create a conservation challenge in and of itself, right? With the development and impacts associated with that migration and increase in population, but it's also a tremendous economic opportunity. And I don't naively assume that sustainable development and economic growth are the same thing, but we do need some bodies. And as you'll see, you're losing bodies in net terms here in the Gila region, and so we want to think a little bit about the kinds of things that do attract people. Turns out natural amenities do, and natural amenities on public lands do. Our research has shown that public lands, and protected public lands in particular, attract faster rates of job growth. And we looked at the non-metro West here, and we looked over a 40-year time period. And we broke the West up. We had to create some thresholds here. The top threshold was counties that have 30% or more of their land base in federal protected status. Those non-metro counties in the West grew their jobs by 345% over the last four decades. Similar counties with no protected federal lands grew their jobs about 83%. So we're not talking about a 10% bonus here or a 20% bonus. We're talking about an over 400% differential in the rate of job creation between counties that have a significant amount of federal protected lands in them and those counties that don't. This is an unbelievable finding, and it's just merely descriptive. There's no fancy analysis here. Now for some fancier analysis. We were able to discern using statistical methods a statistically significant relationship between the presence of these protected public lands and higher per capita income. And in essence, it's a measure of wealth. Per capita income is total income in a region divided by total population. So that definition's clear. In fact, we found that there's a linear relationship within reason. You probably go to 10 million acres, you're going to have a problem with that per capita income number. It's not going to work. But within the range of 50, 100, 150, 200,000 acres, we found that there is a linear relationship between the amount of protected federal land and increase in per capita income for non-metro counties across the West. So on average, for the presence of every 10,000 acres of protected area, there is an increase of $436 in per capita income. So to put that in perspective, if the county has 100,000 acres of protected federal lands, we would expect that county to have a per capita income that's $4,360 that's associated with the presence of that federal protected land. Now, that's on average. And to put that in perspective, the average per capita income for the non-metro West as a whole in 2010 was $34,870. Just wanted to give you a benchmark there to think about it. So how about here in New Mexico? At Headwaters, we've done a number of reports over the years. In 2008, we actually did a report looking at the Gila region. We did a piece looking specifically at natural assets, which was really just a summary of existing research in 2010, looking at southern New Mexico as a whole. And we did a preview of New Mexico here just earlier this year from the West is Best report. And we found, probably not a big surprise, that New Mexico outperforms, like the West, outperforms the rest of the country in the growth of employment, population, and personal income in the last decade here I'm showing you. The industries that are driving it in the same time period, healthcare, professional, scientific, and technical services, and then mining. Now you're blessed in many respects with the energy resources you have in the Permian and San Juan basins, and that mining growth in jobs you're seeing is almost all in, not all, but almost all in energy development, oil and gas development, much of it in gas. So the state as a whole created over 100,000 net new jobs. The majority of those are being created in a mix of services industries. How about the Gila region? Now here we're shifting to a very different perspective. It's quite rural, relatively remote, significant amounts of federal public lands. And when I use the Gila region again, I'm talking about the three county area, including Catron, Grant, and Sierra counties. I'm just showing you here an index over 40 years of population, employment, and personal income on the bottom, and I'm comparing it against the non-metro West. So 1970 is indexed to 100, and then we're just running it out. What's amazing is how you end up at virtually the same place, the same rates of growth across the board. Now, as you'd expect, you see more volatility in the local economy because it's a smaller economy. And you can see these blue lines here are national recessions. And you can see that this smaller economy is quite subject to business cycles, goes up and down. This question of population change is, I think, maybe a difficult one in the region. Overall, in the region over the last 10 years, deaths on an annual basis outstrip births, and more people are leaving than are coming in net terms. And that's led over the last 10, 11 years to a net loss of people in the region. And that's of some concern anytime you see that in net terms. We also see this as a relatively old population, less so here in Grant County. But the median age in Catron County is over 20 years higher than the U.S. in 2010. The yellow bar here is 2000. The blue bar here is 2010. In all cases, it's going up. It's going up across the country. That's inevitable, given the boomer bubble. But it's dramatic here within the region. And you could see on the left, this is where the population cohort that's getting bigger, male and female here. Very rare to see the men in the over 65 category outnumber the women, but they do here. On the right, you can see change in population by age cohort. We're losing, we're gaining. So part of that's just people moving up, and part of that's people moving out. I looked at the tax filing data from the IRS, and it's amazing how parochial the migration patterns are to and from the region here. They're just within the Southwest, almost exclusively. Very interesting. This is a very important graph. It's that 40-year graph for the three-county region, looking at services, non-services, and government. And the important story here is that there are many important stories here, but one of them is the incredible rise of services in the three-county area, creating over 6,800 new jobs in that 40-year period. At the same time, the non-services, and what you're seeing a lot of here is the volatility in mining in particular, lost over 1,000 jobs. And that's not from the peak, that's from 1970. Government has been steadily growing, but probably not growing per 100 people if you were to benchmark it. It's growing as the broader economy and population base grows. What's interesting is what happened here in the early 1980s, and we see this again and again across the West, where for the first time coming out of the early 1980 recession, 82 recession, we saw services de-link from the way it followed the natural resource sectors. And so here what we see is a growth of services independent of what's happening in the mining sector. Now, mining remains really important in these three-county areas. It's 5% of employment in the three-county areas, and because of the high wage rates within the sector, it's 10% of labor earnings in the region. And here in this county here, it's about 7% of direct employment in the mining industry and about 15% of labor earnings. Those are significant numbers, and because of the relatively high rate of pay, the very high rate of pay in that sector, you'll see that that has also ramifications for spending patterns and the rest throughout the community. But the rest of the economy is now uncoupled from that and is growing. And as that grows, we're seeing a growth of labor earnings overall, which is the red line. And just from the early 1980s here, from after the big downturn in the mining in the late 70s, early 80s, just in that growth period there, added over $200 million in labor earnings adjusted for inflation in that 20-year period. Now, what's growing even faster is this green line, the mystery green line called non-labor income. Non-labor income is two things. It's dividends, interest, and rent, which is investment income, and it's government transfer payments to individuals, things like Social Security and Medicare, and also income maintenance programs, aka welfare. Now, the vast majority of non-labor income here as elsewhere is retirement related. It's related to an aging population. And it is the fastest growing source of income. It's now 55% of the total personal income in the three-county region. By the way, it's not uncommon to see a 40-something percent. It's on the high side, but it's not that uncommon. It's now $150 million larger non-labor income is than labor earnings. It's a huge part of your economy, and it's directly related to the aging of the population here and the wealth that they have access to. Now, we can see these patterns here. Earnings per job in red. We saw the high mining sector driving up those earnings in this period as those jobs declined overall and as a share, in absolute terms, and as a share of total employment, those earnings numbers went down. The good news is here from 1990, where the earnings figure, again, this is all adjusted for inflation, so represented in real terms, was about 32,000. It's gone up in the last couple of decades to 35,000. There are a lot of places where we work and analyze some of these issues where that figure is on a steadily downward trajectory. The fact that it's coming up here is a really good news story. Per capita income is going up almost everywhere. It's gone from about 17,000 to 31,000 in real terms over this 40-year period. So it is a relatively stable and growing source of income that's very important. Just want you to see the differential in wages here, because it's really important to appreciate why some people don't want to give up a mining job for a tourism job, for example. The average wages in the non-services, the goods-producing sectors in the three-county region are almost $49,000. They're $69,000 in mining versus $24,000, about half for the services here. And what's happening is as a region, we're doing a relatively good job of growing the service economy, but not as successful a job growing it in its higher wage aspects. And that raises the question, why? I read an excellent economic development master plan for Grant County in preparation for this trip, and I noticed the survey of business owners about what are the significant challenges facing Grant County as it works to improve job and economic growth. By far and away, the number one response was skills in the labor force. And if you ask yourself what it takes to compete in the modern service economy at the higher wage end, it's skills in the labor force. And yet when I look at the character of the community here, and the quality of the landscape, and even the branding of that landscape, there is a public lands asset here that puts you on the map. And that in some ways, if you traded on it successfully, could position communities like Silver City to benefit from some of that higher wage service industry growth we see in the broader region. But just because the public lands are here doesn't mean that they're going to translate into that broader economic opportunity. It's something that you have to pursue and capitalize on. I think I'm just about out of time. But I did want to share one other thing. What are the three primary reasons your business is located in Grant County? Because I don't know how many of you have read the economic development plan for the county, but it's pretty well done. And I want to congratulate if there's anyone here in the room who worked on that. But the top reason people are here is quality of life. The top reason. And if that's true for you, it's probably true for a lot of other people who don't yet know Silver City or Grant County. It means that's it's a huge opportunity. The other two top reasons people are here, they located their business here, historically operated in the county, and proximity to customers and suppliers. So that's kind of, it's a small region or parochial answer. And that's part of the problem. That to succeed in this broader economy, we have to think about some permeability. We have to think about some connections with that larger economy that allow us to tap into some of that dynamism and growth. That's more difficult in rural areas, in remote rural areas that have smaller population bases and economic bases. But we see it happening all the time. And with the resources here, I don't see any reason why it couldn't happen here. And it already is happening here. But I mean, in a more successful way in the high wage arena. So where to from here? And I'm going to make just a few observations as an outsider and excuse the hubris, but and if I'm wrong, just you'll shoot me down. But I think it makes a lot of sense to focus on what's happening with demographics. Let's start with the population out-migration. It's critical to attract and keep younger people and families. They are the entrepreneurs of tomorrow. And it's perfectly healthy people graduate from high school and leave. They should leave. They should go explore. But then think about their choice as they try to settle down with a career and a family. Do we have in place what they'll need when they make that choice? That's a great way to frame the question about what it takes to keep younger families. Attracting and keeping the aging cohort is critical under this demographics question because we have to think about, do we provide the medical services they need or will we lose them when they get to a certain age? The wealth they have and the income they have access to is going to grow and will be a significant opportunity for those communities that can retain and attract those folks. Many people are only, and I already talked to a number of you in the audience here, are only in semi-retirement. And you're giving back to the community, you're involved in businesses, there's a tremendous repository of wisdom that you're giving back and you're putting back in this community. It's another important reason to focus on retaining the elderly. Improving education and skills, it's obviously the number one challenge identified from within this community. It's crucial to compete, as I've suggested. I talked to a number of CEOs for this West is Best project. We profiled them in the report itself, and they said again and again that they locate their businesses in places that have a high quality of life, including access to the outdoors and recreation, because their most talented employees are asking for that. Promoting natural and social assets, again, it's the number one reason people are locating their businesses here or have located their businesses here. It's not a thought exercise. It's why they're here. Well, it may be important to go back through an exercise of identifying and protecting the key natural and social assets that undergird that location inertia that you already have happening here. And it may be a conversation that happens after that about how to market those resources, not just to identify and protect them. It's important to do both. Sometimes we're only marketing without protecting. Sometimes we're only protecting without marketing. I think we need to do both. And this is a place that one could easily think about marketing as a great place to live and work. Lastly, the remoteness factor is important, and investing in transportation and communications is really important for breaking down some of those barriers. If we're left behind on the ability to telecommunicate or have access to fast delivery services and connect to clients in larger markets, we will, I think, continue to have an economy where people are leaving, where our earnings are stagnant or rising very slowly, and we won't capitalize on that larger challenge. And within that challenge and opportunity, I want to just reiterate that I think public lands are a tremendous asset, in part, and we're going to hear about this from our other speakers, apart from how we use them. But just as important is not how we use them, but the fact that we know they're there, the scenery and the backdrop that they provide us, and the branding and quality of life they offer the communities that are surrounded by these public lands. And if you have a chance to take a look at the Broader West is Best report that we have on our website, and I've got cards if you're interested, we talk to the corporate recruiters, we talk to some of the CEOs who have recently relocated their businesses in the West, and we've looked at the shifting industry mix, and specifically how that mix is focused on the services and the high-wage services and what it takes to attract the companies and the employees in those sectors. And then we found in the non-metro West those more rapid rates of job growth and higher per capita income in places that have protected federal lands. And I think we've got a pretty good argument here. I'll entertain the questions, I think, after the other two speakers, but I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Ben. That was stimulating. And we will have the questions and answers afterwards.
Well, it's time to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the panel discussion. Now we'll hear from our second panelist, Joe Sines.
It's now my pleasure to introduce our second presenter, Chiricahua Apache and Huicho descendant Joe Sines is the owner and operator of Wolf Horse Outfitters, a Native American guide service that leads trips to the Gila and Alto Leopold wilderness areas. Joe is a member of the Red Paint Tribal Council, an Apache grassroots organization that hosts the annual Red Paint Powwow and promotes local Apache history and culture. He is also a member of the Mountain Horse Singers, a local powwow and Native songs drum group. Joe's talk will focus on how local Apache culture and history, which is deeply rooted in the land of the Gila, can help fuel our rural economy. Joe?
Thank you. That, to a certain extent, I think quite a bit of it is preaching to the choir here. We all pretty much know what we have here. It was interesting to hear the comments here previously, just, you know, why are we here? For me, you know, to a certain extent, I'm not too different from you guys, mostly because of our history here. Most of us had to return to this area, and that includes me. My ancestors, with my great-grandparents, were the ones that understood this country and lived here. And when they were run off, it took my generation to come back to this area. And so we know the power of this country. We understand it. Unfortunately for us, it was a little bit different. We understood that power. We fought for it. But what was decided was that it was a better place for somebody else. And so we were run off. But we never lost that thought that this country had something really special and we were going to continue to come back. And even for myself here recently, I just found, you know, with my own interest that in reality we had 8 reservations here. The eighth reservation, the latest one is with the Fort Sill people that just have moved into the Aquila Flats. That's the 8th group. And so our tie to this country is pretty intense, and it always has been, and I believe it always will be. What we want to do is, in my generation, coming back to this country, was for us to be able to make a living in some place that we felt comfortable, and somewhere where we knew that country. But in putting together, like I said, when I first came back to this country, I realized what was missing. And within a certain group of us, we began working toward reestablishing ourselves and reestablishing that history here. And we believe that the potential here was just astounding, and that's why we never gave up. That's why we're on our ninth annual, really 10th annual powwow. But that's just the beginning for us. We hope that with the land here, with what we have here, that we can bring much more interest to this area. There is a potential of opportunities and events that we can bring here that will bring attention. For my business alone, what I do is I'm an outfitter, and I take people out into the wilderness. I was fortunate enough that when I began my business, I sort of had a connection with a group of German people. And before 9/11, most of my business was all European. During 9/11 and right after 9/11, the demographics of my clients changed quite a bit because of the restrictions and what happened with 9/11. But it slowly has increased back to where it's half and half now, half European, half American. And I work with three different companies. I work with a travel agency in Germany that is called Indiana Reisen, which is a company that specializes in sending tourists to predominant native areas. The other one is called Cavaliers du Monde, which is a French company that sends horseback riders all around. And I work with a company called Hidden Trails in Canada. And so the worldwide attention to the Gila is there. It's just, I think that we have done somewhat of a poor job of highlighting every potential that we have here. And so, especially with our organization, we hope to try to work on that slowly. We know that the amount of jobs is very critical here. The elements that, with Native people, we usually work on a number of four, and we work with the main elements, and we have them all here. We have fire, we have water, we have air, and we have land. For my business, one of the things that I feel comfortable with what I do here, even though that I specialize in a small group type of setting, is that with my business, I do spread out and employ quite a few people in this area. Everything from horseshoeing to repairs to feed to mechanical work on my vehicle so I can pull the trailer or the horse trailer around. We do end up impacting quite a bit of people. And so, that's one of my interests, is that when I came back to this area, I didn't want to come back here and try to become rich. I wanted to give something back to it because of my history here. And that is what our main interest is. Look, for example, with a powwow, we don't, most of the volunteers that are working, we don't get paid. Our effort is to promote the event for Silver City and help promote the performers. And within the powwow, the economics of the powwow is very difficult here. And I think it's just because it's not an ingrained cultural sharing or a cultural cooperation. And we hope that that'll change in the future. We want to work with Silver City. We want to work with Grant County. The history there is rather difficult, and it's been very resistant, but we keep working at it. We know there's a lot of people here in the area that support us. And so we hope that through our effort of continuing these efforts with whether it's the powwow, whether it's my business, or it's with the other organization that we have, it's called the Chiricahua Apache Alliance, which is one of the original ones here. We do have a certain amount of work that we have done in Arizona, predominantly working with mesquite beans and mesquite flour. And so there is quite a bit. We just need to expand. We need to find those cooperating agencies, those cooperating businesses that will work with us. The majority of us are like Sissy mentioned, that we're basically grassroots people. We're not, we're not set up in corporations. We're not set up in a way that we can easily solicit funding or assistance. So, but I know that because of who we are and why we need to be here, that we will continue to make that available to Silver City, Grant County, the Gila National Forest, the National Park Service, in any way that we can help with that. This drum group that we mentioned, this is just it's also another opportunity for us to share. We performed at the Living Arts Studio over in the Members. They had their grand opening over there, and they asked us to come over and sing. And we thought it was a perfectly fine thing to do, to come over and support them, even though they were not a Native organization. But it's our way of expanding our presence here. It's our way of showing that we have something to offer and something to cooperate with the other people here. And so I'm hoping that, you know, with some questions that we'll be able to talk more in detail about this. I do appreciate these moments to be able to talk and bring these ideas forward. And so again, just to reiterate that we are here to help and work with Grant County, Silver City, and the area. It's only an investment for our history and an investment for our future also. So thank you very much.
And now Catherine Wanek is the innkeeper at the Black Range Lodge in Kingston and serves on the Sierra County and Southwest New Mexico Tourism Boards. Also an accomplished author, photographer, and filmmaker, she has enjoyed living in the beautiful Gila National Forest since 1984. Catherine's presentation will be about green tourism opportunities in Southwest New Mexico. Catherine?
Join us again next week for the conclusion of the Economic Forum. And thanks again for tuning into Earth Matters, a show about earthly matters that impact us all.